Well, good morning. It's Jeff Wine, host of The Car Show here on Sun Sounds Radio. Once again, we've got an action-packed show for you today. Going to catch you up on the latest and greatest of the world of the automobile. Well, the good guys are in town this weekend, and I was out there yesterday, and I'll talk about some of the cool cars that I saw and some of the experiences. Also, talk about Formula One up in Las Vegas. Yeah, last night it was quite Mr. Toad's wild ride. And when I woke up this morning, some unusual news that I really wasn't expecting about the race. I've got a couple cool articles out of old cars, and one about a 62 Cadillac and another one about a 51 Pontiac. We've got a little bit of weird and unusual automotive news to share. Of course, we'll talk about gas prices, and it won't be the car show without a little car talk. You know what to do. Fasten those seatbelts nice and tight. It's going to be a fast ride on the car show. Well, from the pages of Old Car Weeklies, one of my favorite magazines, the title of the article is From Woody to Tin Wagon, the 1951 Pontiac Woody Hales Station Wagon Transitionary Period. Well, practically victories over aesthetics in General Motors post-war station wagons might have been not have been unavoidable, but it didn't happen instantly. It's kind of a transition in the sense that people want to call these tin woodies, explained Colin McCall on his 51 Pontiac Streamliner featured in the magazine. The few years earlier, you would have seen a lot of cars with wood on the outside of the car. A few years later, there would be no wood anywhere. This car still has some wood on the inside. Now, like the rest of the industry, Pontiac had resumed production of civilian vehicles after World War II, by continuing its 1942 models with some minor changes for 1946. Its station wagons returned as a part of its line, and their pre-war predecessors, doors, roof panels, quarter panels, tailgates, roofs, were constructed from wood. That meant they were as attractive as ever, but unfortunately, demanding as ever. Woodies require maintenance far beyond the need of their steel relatives. And one of the things is varnishing is a regular task. Repairs from accidents and damage require skills far past just metal work. The changeover at the first post-war models was a logical point to move away from that traditional wood construction, but GM was careful because they had wanted to give their buyers a choice. Fisher Body 1949 wagon manual tells the story. Chevrolet and Pontiac wagons were available with all steel or steel and wood designs, while Oldsmobile offered a wood body version. Oldsmobile introduced a new post-war body in 1948 in its station wagons. The roof were now steel. Side doors used less wood than they had in 1947, although steel had not been completely replaced the wood in the quarters and the tailgates. Chevrolet and Pontiacs used the same station wagon body as Olds for 49, but changes came quickly one by one as the divisions dropped their woodies. Now, the 1950 versions were all steel, but they were aware that some of those appreciated the look of wood, and some of the steel bodies were stamped to give the impression of being woodies. They were also helped along with the use of a wood grain decal, but the basic body wagon still remained a production for Pontiac and Chevrolet through 1954. That was the first year in which General Motors wagons were completely built using steel structure. And the final Buick had its final Woody in 1953, making it not only the last holdout at General Motors, but also the final example of a production of an American Woody. Now, the Pontiac, although it had the traditional flathead sixes and eights, would continue to use those until 1955. Eight-cylinder in Mr. McCall's vehicle displaces 268 cubic inches, makes 116 horsepower, and drives through a hydromatic transmission, a combination that clearly met the approval of the motoring public, as Pontiac produced 252,000 eight-cylinder cars with automatics in 1951, compared to only 64,000 eights with a manual transmission. Now, despite the obvious and understanding popularity of the drivetrain, that wasn't the biggest feature that sold McCall on his Pontiac when he bought it used in 2016. I found the car on the internet, and I liked the looks of the car. I was at a stage in my life where I could handle another one, so I took a chance on this. McCall pointed out something that is known to nearly everyone in the hobby, namely the inherent risk of buying a collector car that is great when you're buying it unseen. In this case, the station wagon, you recall, is perched, worked out well, nothing rising to the nightmare level in repairs or restorations. I have no complaints, McCall said. The car needed some mechanical work, but nothing too seriously. The kind of nothing too complicated. Some cooling system issues, but everything else, it's fine. Now, when he says it does fine, he is coming close to an exaggeration point. He had driven from Pontiac. He had driven the Pontiac a few miles from his home in Pennsylvania to a car show, and with no, the car is not perfect, but he would have been happy to take it further because the car seemed to be driving in excellent condition. Now, this car has a straight eight flathead engine, which is 1930s technology, and it's interesting in a 1951 car, but it's reliable, it doesn't leak, and it always starts. Now, once you're on the highway going, oh, let's say 50 or more, it's a nice driver. The steering is obviously not power steering. It kind of steers a little bit like a tank. But what's interesting is I also own a 1941 Cadillac, 10 years older than this. It's just as big and just as heavy, and obviously no power steering. But the car, well, you'd almost think it does have power steering. It's so much better than this. So 10 years later, you know, it's a Pontiac, but it's not a Cadillac. So you know the difference. Relatively short time since the Pontiac brand disappeared. It's been a slow-moving point and slipping from the collective memory. McCall guesses that when he goes to some of these car shows, about half the people don't know exactly what the car is. They need some clarification. People who have antique cars, well, they know what it is. But many spectators, they really don't. Now, they might not realize by looking at this car, but McCall's experience says by seeing another station wagon like this, it's a rare occurrence. It's very unusual. There have been many times and many shows that there's been no other car like mine. I've only seen one other guy with a car like this at one show. Now, factoring this in, well, if he were to stop for gas, how many people would correctly identify this car? The answer is, well, no one. I've had a 57 Chevy since 1980. I used to drive that on the Garden State Parkway in New Jersey, and when people would look at it like it was from Mars. Now, there was a time when everybody in America and in this country knew what these cars were. It's kind of a shame because I think these cars are closely related to the history of this company in many, this country in many ways. But if people have no interest, well, they're going to lose out on this. They'd also be losing out on something else. Despite the steering required to muscle this car at low speeds, the Pontiac actually is an excellent driver. Best of all, McCall said, becoming comfortable behind the wheel wouldn't require much of a learning curve. About 5 minutes it would take. Now, because it's an automatic, and it's an automatic from the 50s, it's not all that different from an automatic in the 2020s. The suspension's a little stiffer. That's about all it is. Now, his least surprising observation about the Pontiac is he has no plans on letting it go. I would keep and drive this car, well, as long as I can drive. Why would I get rid of it? I'm happy with it. People like it. When I go to car events and see other cars to chat about, start learning things, it certainly is a conversation starter. Well, let's talk a little Formula One news from last night, and the headline reads, Verstappen wins in Vegas to close the gap in the title race with just two races to go. Well, Max Verstappen took a commanding victory at Las Vegas Grand Prix after jumping the skittish pole-sitter Lando Norris at the start to keep his title hopes mathematically alive. The victory put Verstappen just 42 points behind Norris and only 12 points behind Oscar Piastri, who holds second in the championship standings, but took another blow after the Australian came in fourth in the race. Norris reacted well to the lights, but was too eager to try to cover Verstappen on the inside at the start. The title leader aggressively chopped to his left, but in doing so, missed the braking point and sailed off into the runoff zone. Verstappen easily sliced through and moved into first. Norris came perilously close to hitting him when he rejoined. During the melee, George Russell beat the McLaren into turn four to pinch second place. The race, the first dry session since Thursday's practice, entered a management phase with no driver pushing their tires too hard to prevent the debilitating graining and achieve a one-stop strategy. That's right, they only stopped one time for tires. Russell was the first mover on the podium battle. The Briton had been on the offense against Verstappen early, but reported on lap 14 the steering problem that had hurt his qualifying performance had reoccurred. His race became fairly defensive, trying to keep Norris at bay for second place. He stopped on lap 18 to switch from medium tires to hard tires to run the rest of the race. Norris stayed out to benefit from the new fresh air ahead of him and put his foot down to try to minimize the undercut effort. Now, a small tire offset boosted Russell by pushing hard earlier to catch Verstappen after the Dutchman stopped, taking extra life out of his tires. The combination of Russell's steering problem, Norris ended up with a significant pace advantage through the end of the race. McLaren locked into Mercedes' rear end's gearbox on lap 33. Russell signaled over the radio he couldn't fight any harder, so he had to give up the position. Well, normally like this, Verstappen said, this is a tough race for us. Normally, we are a great push on these tires, but we had a little bit more understeer and had to, a little bit more time controlling the car. Norris was told to aggressively lift and coast on the final laps, blowing out his deficit to 20 seconds. He said, I let Max have this win, he joked. I just braked too late at the start of the race. This was my mistake. It wasn't my best performance out there, but when the guy wins by 20 seconds, it's because he's done a better job and he's been quicker than us. So, very interesting race. my buddy and I were texting at the start, and he said, do you think Max will jump Lando at the start? Because Max was starting on in the second position, and Lando was starting in first, and I said, he's done it before. Why wouldn't he do it again? And Lando let Max have it at the beginning of the race by his own mistake. So Max Verstappen wins the race. Lando Norris finishes in second. George Russell in third. Oscar Piastri in fourth. And Kimi Antonelli was in fifth. Now, that's what happened before I went to bed and woke up this morning with this new news. Headline reads this morning, both McLarens have been disqualified from the Las Vegas Grand Prix. Well, both McLaren drivers have been disqualified from the Las Vegas Grand Prix, with Max Verstappen now level with points with Oscar Piastri for second place and only 24 points behind Lando Norris. Originally, Lando Norris had finished second and Piastri fourth, as Verstappen led every lap, having overtaken the pole sitter on the first turn. The championship leader's pace dropped off in the closing laps, as McLaren admitted that they were managing an issue. In post-technical inspection, FIA had noted that both cars had registered excessive plank wear. Now, just for those who are not understanding exactly what this is, there's a plank underneath the car that has a minimum thickness that is allowed to have some wear during the race. Well, the wear was higher than it was supposed to be. It's supposed to be a minimum thickness of 9 millimeters, and their cars measured less than that. They don't believe, according to the article, it says, although the stewards believe that this was not a result of an intentional setup from McLaren, technical infringements can carry penalties of disqualifications. Now, the team argued that mitigating circumstances existed and there was an additional unexpected porpoising, which meaning the car kind of bouncing up and down, limited opportunity to test because of the weather on day one and shortened practice sessions. The stewards' decisions read, further teams submitted to the degree that the breach was lower than prior breaches in the regulations from 2025. Quote, the FIA argued that unfortunately there were no provisions in the regulations for any precedents for penalties or unusual penalties. The FIA also noted that it held strongly in its view that a breach was unintentional, but that was not a deliberate attempt to circumvent the regulations. So the cars being disqualified promotes George Russell to second place and Kimi Antonelli into third, Charles Leclerc fourth, Carlos Sainz fifth, and so on. So very interesting that now both McLaren cars have been disqualified. They've already won the manufacturer's title, and they were chasing the driver's title. And now Max Verstappen is right on their tail with just two races to go. So this is big news in the world of Formula One. Well, another article from the pages of Old Car Weekly, and this is called A Participant's Perspective, showing his 1963 Cadillac at the Concours event. Well, it was 6 a.m. on a crisp fall morning last October with the sun just getting ready to pop over the horizon, and I was walking onto the Audrian Newport Concours and Motor Week at the Breakers Mansion in Newport, Rhode Island. Under the spotlight and under the fanfare that was awaiting me, it was like a dream. I was like, how the heck did I get here? Well, all the activity around me was hypnotizing. It was like a human beehive with the sounds of power tools and people everywhere shouting instructions. And oh, the lights. Yes, the lights from the Breakers. It added the magic as we set the stage for a dreamlike atmosphere. Indeed, it was electricity in the air. As I walked toward the field, I was greeted by a young lady who inquired whether I'd like a coffee or an espresso. Wow, that was amazing. I put my order in for black coffee with a gracious smile. She obliged and handed me a coffee and thanked me for coming. Amazing. As I approached my car that I had left in its show position the night before, I could see the fact that it worked out I did not cover my car, my Cruella, my 1963 Cadillac Series 62 convertible was draped in a beautiful glaze of morning dew. So all I had to do was wipe her down, and that would do most of the detail work for me. As I gazed around the field and breathed in all the sights, I realized that what had just entered into my vision was the promised land and a feeling of royalty. I wiped down my Cadillac and exchanged pleasantries with the gentleman next to me doing the same. I offered an extra towel to the man on the other side of my car and breathed in the magic and the camaraderie. I was greeted with a morning pastry and then breakfast at 8 a.m. Many delightful smiles from the people so early in the morning was like a dream. I'd never experienced anything like this. Now, just the night before, when we had checked in and received our credentials, we were each gifted with a gorgeous leather bag with beautiful goodies inside, such as a leather keychain, hats, along with some other niceties. As the morning we set up for the concourse, I met some incredible people and was assigned two concierges in case I needed anything. I mean anything, from a coffee to food to even a mixed drink. I was assigned a car manager of sorts. He took down my phone number and he said he would call me when the judges were at my car. He handled all the other needs. It was just amazing. The day was absolutely magical. Displays of all cars, all models, from early iron to classic icons. Everyone was so bright and cheery. I had a good conversation with Jay Leno. I had him sign my lanyard. I also took down names and numbers of new friends that I had made and watched my best friend, Janine, who I'd taken along with me, relax and then take pictures. At the end of the day, I received an honorable mention and a ribbon. Well, a fancy way of saying third place in my class. But I was shocked to receive them, as the competition was heavy in my class. It was an absolute honor for sure. As the show concluded, we said our goodbyes and packed up our memories, and it turned out to be the best was yet to come. Ah, yes, the exit. As we drove down the staging lane to leave, we found it lined with people who were applauding and waving and taking pictures and shouting congratulations. It honestly brought tears to my eyes. And not only did this hit me emotionally, as we left, people were lined up on both sides of the street doing the same thing. A vision I'll never forget. Now, the hardest part of this experience, now that I look at our local car shows differently, not in a bad way, but as my friend Laurie said, welcome to the other side. There are many people for me to thank that put on this event by financing this car show. A truly magical experience I will never, ever forget. Well, from the weird and unusual automotive news from the pages of The Drive, the headline reads, excavator in transportation hits bridge so hard that the arm punches through the road. As a wise man once said, measure twice, cut once. Excavators in transportation just can't help themselves but hit a bridge every once in a while. It's a tale as old as time and as just as a song as a rhyme. We published it practically another story earlier this year. But this incident happened on Wednesday in Kansas, and thanks to a unique detail, the excavator's arm punched clear through the deck of the bridge. Now, I'm not saying this is the first time this has ever happened in history, but certainly I haven't seen this before. And how fast was this big rig going for the equipment to plow in that far? And how strong is this arm on the excavator? Or how weak is this bridge? Now, the poor Caterpillar 323 never stood a chance. Of course, it helps the specific excavator weighs nearly 55,000 pounds, so there's a lot of inertia to say. Local TV outlet at KVOE reports said the driver was sent to a nearby hospital in Topeka with minor injuries. It's a wonder that he didn't go flying through the windshield. Well, the bridge on U.S. Highway 75 will be closed for who knows how long. Certainly Rome wasn't built in a day, and neither will this bridge be rebuilt in a little time. I don't imagine this route, which is 10 miles south of Melvin, Kansas, is that highly trafficked compared to a busy interstate, but nonetheless, it's going to cause some headaches for some local drivers. Thankfully, no other vehicles were involved in the incident. So just imagine this crane's arm is bent down, and it plows straight through the bridge, almost like a hot knife through butter, and ends up in the middle of the bridge. It is a sight to see, and I'm certainly glad I wasn't the guy driving that truck. It was the final Good Guys show of the season. It's happening out at Westworld, and that is going on today through 3 o'clock. Had such a wonderful time out there yesterday. Saw so many wonderful, wonderful vehicles. Talked to some friends. Some of my favorites was a beautiful blue 1959 Chevrolet El Camino, a gorgeous 67 Mustang, fuel injected, a 63 Ford pickup truck with a blower sticking out of the top of the hood, looked like it made massive amounts of horsepower, and a Buick Grand National that was the one that was one of the award winners, was probably my favorite vehicle. So I want to thank the guys at Good Guys for always being giving me a press pass to come out and check out the cars and talk about it. Don't forget, they'll be back in March 13th and 14th of 2026 out at Westworld. And if you want some more information and get set for that next year, or still the chance to scoot out this afternoon since they're there, it's out at Westworld in Scottsdale on North Pima Road. And want more information, go to good-guys.com. I'm talking a little gas prices with our friends over at AAA. Right now, gas prices are stable, at least around the rest of the country. $3.07 is the national average right now. Arizona is at $3.35. New Mexico, $2.85. Colorado, $2.68. So that feels, I feel like that's come down a little bit. Utah, $3.14. Nevada, $3.80. California, $4.60. That's actually down a couple of pennies. Last week, I believe it was $4.64. Over in Texas, $2.66 a gallon. $2.53 in Oklahoma. That's some reasonably priced gas. All right, let's talk about what's going on with gas prices here in Arizona. Well, actually, I feel like our gas prices, it's just a slight tick up. Costco right now in Tucson at $2.63. Arco Station on Park Avenue in Tucson at $2.63. The Walmart on Commerce in Tucson at $2.68. The Maverick Station in Marana at $2.69. And the Fast Trip in Casa Grande at $2.71. So certainly cheap gas if you're heading south. So if you're heading that way, better fill up. All right, let's talk local gas prices here in Metro Phoenix. Well, $3.09 is the least expensive gas that we can find right now, and that's on Val Vista Drive in Gilbert. The Marathon Station on Apache Trail in Apache Junction is at $3.09 at the Arco Station, and these are cash prices at the Arco Station on 43rd Avenue in Phoenix. The Costco in Gilbert, $3.13. The Sam's Club, obviously matching the price right across the street, is at $3.13 as well. The Arco Station on Grand Avenue in Sun City at $3.13. The Arco Station on West Peoria, 35th Avenue in West Peoria, cash price again at $3.14. The Quick Trip on 75th Ave in Peoria at $3.16. And then the Costco at 33rd Avenue in Phoenix at 319 as well. I can tell you this, I paid $3.48 for at the Costco in Scottsdale. Certainly gas prices have not come down in Metro Phoenix. Well, it's time for a little car talk. Dear Car Talk, this story is 50 years old, but it's been bothering me for a long time. My first car was a 65 Chevelle, handed down from my older brother. Being a teenager, I wrecked the front end within 3 months of ownership. The radiator was busted in the wreck and it had a leak, so I left the car parked for the winter and then the block cracked. I left home for a year for a job, came back. My dad was driving the car. I asked him how he fixed it. He said a mechanic told him to pour a jar of mustard into the radiator, which he did. He said it plugged the crack in the block, and he's been driving it ever since. Is this possible? That's from Jim. Is it possible your dad poured mustard into your Chevelle's radiator? Sure. Is it possible that it could have fixed the crack block? No, not even Gray Poupon can fix a cracked block. Now, a radiator operates at 15 to 18 PSI, and that's going to blow any dried mustard all over the closest apron. Now, there are additives that can at least temporarily seal up small cracks in a block or in a radiator. Products like Bars Leaks and Port Seal work by mixing with your coolant. Then they leak out through the crack, and when they get exposed to air, they harden. And sometimes, and I say sometimes, we'll seal up the cracks, and sometimes for quite a while. Now, I think what is more likely happened is your dad was actually just driving the car very gently, and that prevented it from overheating completely. And he probably didn't take it on too many highway trips. And maybe if all his trips were short distances, well, and I'm pretty sure, like you, he didn't drive like a knucklehead with this car. Now, had you driven it after the mustard fix, Jim, it probably would have seized. Whether it's Gildan's, French's, Coleman's, or withstanding, mustard is not going to fix a cracked block in a car. So I think it was more luck and driving choices than mustard. But if this story is a part of your family lore and you want to preserve it, well, you could just pretend you actually never read this article. Yeah, I think this makes a lot of sense. Certainly at that pressure and in those certain situations, something like this mustard in the radiator is probably not actually going to work. But he's right. There are other products that you can pour into your engine, or into your radiator that will potentially, and I say that potentially, help fix a leak. But in reality, the best way to do something like this is to get the car fixed right, especially if you're going to want to drive it for any time in the future. Well, that's all the time we have for the car show today, folks. My name is Jeff Wine, and we'll meet you back again on the radio next Sunday, and you're listening to Sun Sounds Radio of Arizona.